Welcome to episode 118 of the Boulak podcast. I'm Marsha Links Quayle with you today from Rabat, Morocco. And with me as always is Ursula Lindsay. We're joined today by Sara Yassin in New York City to talk about the new Palestine-focused online publication, The Key. Welcome, Sara. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to do this.
For those of you who don't know, Sara Yassin is a Palestinian-American journalist and editor with more than a decade of experience in newsrooms in the U.S. and U.K. She's currently the editor-in-chief of The Key, an online publication built by the Palestine Festival of Literature. She was managing editor of the L.A. Times, and before that, she was at BuzzFeed News for almost 7 years, where she focused mostly on audience development and eventually became the site's managing editor. So we wanted to start out today, Sara, if you could introduce us to The Key. How did it come about? How did you become involved in it? And what are its sort of aims and aspirations?
Yeah, thank you so much. I want to say before all of that, I met Marsha and she became my friend. So that's very key point in my trajectory as a human. So this is very exciting for me.
Because we were PalFest roommates.
We were PalFest roommates, you know, it was a very exciting time. So this is just such a pleasure. And there's no one who has been sort of a bigger advocate for me, just when it comes to like thinking about literature and Palestine and the world than Marsha. She's always been such a big sounding board for me. So it's wonderful to be here. And Ursula, it's wonderful to meet you.
Yeah, likewise.
Well, of course. So The Key was an idea that, you know, was sort of born out of a lot of conversations about sort of what kinds of spaces we needed in media after the genocide showed a lot of the cracks and a lot of the places that exist out there in a kind of mainstream space, right? So to kind of give you a little bit of background about that, plus like kind of the PalFest connection, you know, I as Marsha said, like, you know, we both were on PalFest in 2013.
Maybe we should just tell people quickly what PalFest is in case they don't know.
Yeah. Oh yeah, that is true. That is a good
point. It's so we're all graduates of it and adore it, but just the very quick rundown of what it is or has been, because it's changed over the years a bit.
So the absolute legend Hedef Soueif founded the Palestine Festival of Literature in 2009. And historically what it's been is a traveling literature festival where, you know, notable authors from around the world, like truly you cannot, you know, if you go to the PalFest website, you can see some of the authors that have passed through this literature festival, hugely impactful, hugely important, takes the authors through Palestine and shows them what's happening while also having, you know, different forms of engagement with, you know, both the literary community and intellectual community in Palestine across all of historic Palestine, while also having these public events. And I think it's, you know, I'm sure for both of you as well, it's such a magical and phenomenal and just formative thing to experience.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, both in terms of the actual experiences that you have on PalFest, but also I think the thing that I have personally always found to be so, you know, important about PalFest is that it really meets people where they are without watering down the politics, without tiptoeing around the situation, without, you know, it creates space and creates conversation with so much clarity and just so much, you know, fearlessness, I think. So I feel like the impact of PalFest is something that, you know, people might not even realize it, but they felt it, right? Like, and that's not just about Ta-Nehisi Coates writing the message, you know, sort of as a sort of thing that was born out of PalFest. It's, you know, lots of different authors have gone through PalFest, or like PalFest has been important in like organizing different kinds of like, you know, discussions and debates and events and just kind of different important movements and moments in kind of cultural spaces. So I just think that, you know, this is just such a hugely important organization that I respect so much, not only because it is led by two people who I think, like, I just think, you know, all of the people that are, you know, keeping PALFest running are some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life. And I wish to be just even slightly as smart as they are. So do we feel like I captured PALFest?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think one could go kind of, because every year, every group of people, everybody, like you say, comes out of it, I think, like, completely overwhelmed and, like, moved and transformed. But I think which, and yeah, and what's great about it is like, so thoughtful and so, like, I mean, it's, yeah, like, the relationship when you're there feels so, like, authentic, like, and sort of, like, you're really being just educated, actually, and transformed by being there and going through it, and the encounters are amazing. And I always thought it was such a beautiful idea to, like, because people have such a hard time moving or traveling, and books have such a hard time coming and going in and out of Palestine, and the idea is to somehow kind of, like, break those barriers, and it's amazing.
Yeah, and I mean, I think that's the thing, is that there is this, like, real thoughtfulness and real intentionality behind how, you know, Omar and Yasmin sort of run these different parts of the organization. And I just think it is so formative for so many people. I mean, even Molly Crabapple's new book, I mean, the sort of, like, sort of little seeds of her, you know, digging into that story, some of that for her was planted while she was in Gaza, you know, after the sort of, like, official PALFest trip. So this is what it's been historically, right? Is this, you know, annual literature festival that I think has been very significant. So while I was still at the paper when they were kind of going through this point, but, you know, once the genocide began, you know, they had to think about, you know, what does it mean to run this sort of important literature organization that has these associations with all of these different authors and writers, and be in this moment where, okay, you had the very practical constraint of not being able to go to Palestine, but also there was this urgency to have certain kinds of conversations that, like, needed to be happening, but a lot of institutions and a lot of places were too terrified to do them and too terrified to have them. Mm. And you had all of these authors and writers who are, like, world-class, the top writers that we all know, who suddenly were in a position where they were being subjected to censorship. I mean, you know, one of the top examples and early on examples of this was Viet Thanh Nguyen being pulled from the 92nd Street Y, right? So that signaled the cultural space, the cultural sphere, as you have known it, does not allow this conversation to happen in this moment. So I think that what PALFest did was meet the moment and create sort of a response and a space to have that kind of, like, cultural and political engagement. And I think, you know, it was some of the most urgent and important programming, but it was also very good programming and also very, you know, I feel like, I don't know if you guys have gone to any of these events in sort of like since October 2023, but, like, there's just something very, like, you can feel sort of a catharsis within the audience, because there is a safety that comes in these events that's so powerful.
Mm. You're talking about some of these public events where people have spoken and had discussions, and mm-hmm. we're talking about in New York and in London. I have only seen them on video, and events that have had to be, like, moved and rescheduled because they've had difficulties finding a venue that would actually let them take place. And yeah, and then when finally there is a space where people can come and they can hear and speak, like you say, freely about what's happening, and they've been completely packed. And I mean, you I guess have attended some of these.
Yeah. And I actually, so I left the paper in January, 2024. And then I was just kind of like, you know, I left over layoffs, and I just, you know, layoffs / like, I just didn't want my career to be, like, sort of managing decline, which I think is unfortunately the, like, sort of, like, media leader job right now. And I just didn't want that to be my track. So, you know, I was just, like, thinking about what I wanted to do. And, you know, PALFest sort of was you know, it was like, I think people don't realize how much it punches above its weight. Like, you know, it's something that, you know, has been sort of operating at a capacity larger than what it normally operates at, right? So because there has been this like really urgent need to kind of have this programming. So I organized a couple of events for PALFest in Los Angeles, Minneapolis, and Detroit, and Oakland. And, you know, the sort of main thing was talking about the genocide within, like, the intersection between genocide and literature and culture in these different places, and sort of fine-tuning them for each place. So, you know, for example, in Los Angeles, there was like a focus on entertainment industry. And so we had a couple of people who were in Hollywood and had sort of experienced some repercussions for being vocal. We had a panel with folks like that. We had a panel where, you know, we kind of had a little more of a, you know, sort of bent around the kind of like conversation about culture and censorship. So it was, and it was interesting in Minneapolis. I think we focused a little more on the kind of like it was interesting because like in all of these areas, I partnered with like local organizations, and I was like, let's think about like, what is the thing that the community needs? I partnered with local people in each of these places and, you know, in local organizations, and just really thought about like, what is the program that you want? What are the writers? Who are the writers that you want to come here and to have conversations and to do these events? And at every single one of these events, people came up to me afterwards and they were like, I needed this. I want more of this. Mm. Where can I get more of this? Right. And so obviously for me as a journalist and as someone who has focused on the media, I was like thinking a little bit about like, you know, how do you bring together that kind of programming and the fact that you have this very urgent and apparent gap within the kind of like media space, right? Like where, you know, you have this real failure from these kind of mainstream outlets to kind of cover things adequately. So, and I'm not the only person who, like, I feel like it's always important to say, like, I'm not the first person to try to solve this problem, and I'm not going to be the last person to try to solve this problem. And that there are so many cool and interesting outlets that have like, and like journalists who have like popped up in this moment to try to respond to it. So I think that like, part of this is taking some of the things that I feel like I've learned in kind of more mainstream spaces and combining that with the, I think, heft and positioning of PALFest to create this publication that I think is just already like having such an impact, like just even from people telling me kind of what has resonated with them and what has meant something to them. And so I think my hope is to continue to sort of, you know, publish things that I think are highlighting, you know, not only these sort of like gaps in coverage in the cultural sort of like literary kind of like more kind of like in-depth sphere, but also to think about, well, what is the future of media? And what is the future of, you know, what does it mean to think about, because I think the thing that was felt inadequate, like while being in a newsroom, was sort of seeing this thing shift where you're like, okay, well, like most Americans seem to think what's happening is wrong. And that like, what is that like the information about what's happening is kind of not solid. So just thinking from that perspective, you know, what does it mean to publish for a mainstream audience that has a different baseline knowledge and a different baseline sort of like understanding of this issue than you thought, right? So, and because these institutions are so worried about, you know, decline in all the different forms that it exists, they're not, it's too scary to engage with these things that feel so sort of like existentially threatening. So, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but that's kind of like, that's sort of like all of the different things that were sort of in my mind when I was thinking like, okay, well, like, what do we want to make? Like, what do we want to do? And you know, Ahmad was the head of PALFest. Like, we were talking about, you know, okay, well, what would it look like to build a sort of publication that, you know, pulls from the writing of these people who are, you know, very important to the PALFest world. And I've been part of PALFest and part of its community, but like giving them the chance to write about these subjects more on their terms. You know, I think also very practically, a lot of people don't want to write for The Atlantic anymore, or for the New York Times anymore, or for different places because of feeling like these places are going to either censor them or, you know, tiptoe around them or that kind of thing. So, yeah, I think that that's a very long way of saying that I think that this publication is just supposed to be another way to figure out what's the next, you know, what is the next category of media that has staying power and, actually, you know, speaks to values that are, you know, that are not negotiable, right? Like, what does it mean to publish like this when your starting point is you don't have to say what, you don't have to argue that what's happening is a genocide. Yeah. You don't have to argue that Palestinians are humans. So what are you going to say? You know, so that's kind of like the starting point. That was very long-winded.
I'm sorry. I think that's, and I mean, I think that that point you're making, it's this, that to have the starting point and the context and the framework be something that you already know. It's like everybody's been going crazy for the last 3 years because, like you say, you're reading these articles in which a sort of such violence is being done to your like common sense and to the English language and to like basic facts by like trying to shoehorn things into a framework that is not shared. Like the average reader, even I think in the States, does not buy this anymore. And it's kind of being shoved down their throats. Like, I think it's more than trying to manage decline. There's like just an absolutely like aggressive agenda on the part of like, I guess, media owners. And we see them even having doubled down on it, you know, since with like these acquisitions and firings and so to just, I mean, I've experienced this as a writer. Like, I had a small falling out with a publication that I worked with at a certain point because it started to feel like I was the only person who wanted to say anything, who expected anybody else to say anything, who expected anybody else to write anything. It just felt like, and then they published something that I disagreed with enormously, and then I had to like part ways. And then the breathing space that you have when you're actually contributing to a publication where it feels like somehow I'm not going against the grain of the whole editorial line by just saying things the way I think they are.
Yeah.
Like, that's amazing. Like, that just feels like you can breathe again. Like, okay, we don't even need to insist on it because we all know the starting point, like you say.
Yeah, no, completely. And I think, so it's interesting because, you know, from my perspective, like, I think that in some cases, you know, certainly with like the Ellisons, right? Or like, you know, in the case of like the New York Times, there's enough documented that like there's a real top-down approach. There are places where you have this like sort of like top-down aggressive agenda kind of like setting thing. But I think the thing that's terrifying is that in a lot of places, a lot of these things run on autopilot. So like, and I think that that actually is very critical when understanding the like sort of American media landscape. It a lot of decisions are made because people are used to doing things the way they've always done them. Or like you have, you know, and also sometimes that like, you know, it's very shaped by the fact that, you know, you don't see it as an issue to hire someone who had been in the IDF, right? As like a correspondent or whatever, right? But like, beyond these things, like you just have people who have like a concept of what balance is and what bias is, who just haven't had to question it, right? And so like that, I think for me, is one of the scariest things, because journalists are not supposed to be making choices based off of fear, you know? You're supposed to be making decisions based off the truth. So I think that that to me is, that's why I kind of like, that's like one of my like sort of like like having been on like that sort of side of the fence, like I think it's just like people don't want a bad day. And I think that the thing is like these sort of like pro-Israel, like very, very, very Zionist, like sort of entities have like weaponized the mechanisms. And I mean, frankly, like the sort of malaise of these places to like actually help push along these the silence. Cause like if you're on the receiving end of like one of these like, you know, email campaigns,
right, where you're accused of being like an anti-Semite to start with and like, you know, just on from there, like, yeah, it's awful.
Yeah.
And people don't know what to do and it puts you on the back foot.
Yeah. And also it stays in your head, right? Like even if you look at like, man, like I was someone, I was in Palestine for all of November and someone showed me an article with like from the '80s from the LA Times. And, you know, there was like language in it that like, I feel like I was sort of watching arguments and conversations about whether or not these language, like these words should have been used. And like in the '80s, they were just using them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like using occupied, right? Like you remember in 2021, all of the American newsrooms were arguing about whether or not they should be using the word occupied. They were just using it in the '80s. And I think it's just that these like lobbying groups have like, are like relentless and use, you know, all of the mechanisms that these papers use for like transparency and accountability in order to push their agenda. And this is like sort of to me very much a phenomenon that is powerful because I think that journalists and newsrooms, like these, they're so stretched and so sort of like beleaguered at this point that like you just don't want to have a bad day and you just don't want to think about what you're doing. And I think to me that that is like a very, very dangerous thing. And there are, of course, like there are people who have agendas and try to push things in certain ways. And there's lots of really kind of like worrying stories about that. Like I've been working on a story where I've been speaking to journalists in mainstream newsrooms, like since the start of the genocide. And like some of the things I'm hearing are pretty awful, right? Like there are people, but like that was the thing that I found in the conversations was a little bit of like what aligns a little more with my experience, which is just that like you have a bunch of scared people who are really scared of, you know, either their bosses getting mad at them or people getting mad at them on the internet or like making a decision that feels like straying from the way that they'd always done things.
Yeah, I guess what I hear the most often from people is they turn in a story and the editor has watered down the lead and the headline and the conclusion so much that it no longer resembles what it is that they turned in from a point of trying to, from a point of fear.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Of like, I mean, not, let's not rock the boat, but I mean, yeah, it's whatever, you know, conformism, careerism, job insecurity. Like, I mean, there's a lot of factors going into it and,
so it's great to have this publication where people can feel free to write the thing that they believe is true.
Yeah. So given the freedom to actually, you know, the freedom that you guys have given yourselves by what, let's talk about some of the things that you have already published.
Yeah. I mean, and I want to be clear that like, you know, this is in a sense, it's thinking about what does, and we're, like, I think it's just we're very stretched thin, but like trying to articulate, you know, well, what is our standard and how do we talk about things and how do we approach things? Right. And I think that for me, you know, I want to sort of solve for this problem, right? Of like, well, how do we say the things that we know to be true in a way that's accessible for as many people as possible? How do you do that without watering down the politics, the heart of what someone's trying to say, but how do you do it in a way that's accessible, right? Because that to me is the thing I feel the strongest about, is that I want someone who cares about Palestine to be able to to understand what you're trying to say. So for example, you know, one of the pieces that I'm most proud of is this essay by Lamahouri, who's a psychoanalyst, a Palestinian psychoanalyst, and it's called The Conscripted Container. And, you know, in this very, very like just raw and beautiful essay, she brings to life this concept of mawjoud la yujad, which means to exist and not exist. So basically, she creates this clinical language for an experience that I've heard, like myself and other Palestinians who existed in these kind of institutions that were designed to break us. She created language for that, right? So me and her, we worked, she was so phenomenal to work with. We worked really closely together to think about, you know, in a sense, we were almost combining my skills with her skills, which was, I was like, so many people want the language to talk about this thing. So how do we make this accessible for, like, let's say the person who works at some random think tank and has like experienced some version of this, right? But like might not have as much of a sort of like psychoanalytic framework to like, you know, understand it, right? So I found that to be such a rewarding experience because I had people texting me who came from very different universes who were like, this, I have been wanting to be able to describe what this feels like, and I haven't been able to find the words, and this gave me the words for it, which I think is very meaningful.
Yeah. And I think also it's, I mean, you know, I don't have this particular experience of, you know, the psychoanalytic erasure of being Palestinian in particular, but I read it with great interest. I feel like I discovered or understood things from reading it. I mean, these are things that one can relate to because, of course, parts of people are erased in different contexts in different ways. You know this in history or in your personal experience. So it's a like really fascinating and interesting and sort of like moving piece to read. She also includes her experiences with her own therapist. And then it's like, I mean, I don't know what the process was like working with her, but because she's also writing about a sort of peeling away kind of layers of her own like denial, or I guess, or ways in which she kind of twisted herself or stories that she told about herself. And then she's rereading them and telling and sort of shocked at how like she misrepresented herself to herself. I mean, so I think a lot of people can relate to that experience of having twisted yourself into a shape that's not true or felt yourself to be erased. But then it's like explains, you know, how it sort of particularly worked in this context for this person.
I mean, it's interesting because, you know, she does talk about this way that you sort of like contort yourself for compliance, right? Like where like, and you know, for me, what's very interesting in editing this publication is that like, you know, sort of thinking about, okay, readjusting a lot of the instincts that I have and like sort of, you know, questioning some of my own sorts of, you know, the kinds of like, how do you reinterpret these skills that you have in a new environment, right? And thinking about like, how do you engage with these past versions of yourself, which like you want to be compassionate towards them, but also like, it's really a matter of survival, right? And I do think for a lot of Palestinians, you know, you just, I mean, there are so many shades of this, like, you know, the fact that like, you know, my dad drives for Uber and, you know, when someone hears his accent and they ask him where he's from, some days he's going to say Jordan because he doesn't want to talk about it. To me, that's another version of the conscripted container, right? Where it's like, I know that revealing this thing is going to make you see me as a non-human, or as much as I sort of like attach myself to this thing, you're going to see me as a non-human. And I think that that like, that sort of violence is so fascinating because of the way that like Lema, I think what was really important, she drew a line between sort of this like very, I mean, in a sense, almost like banal daily form of violence that Palestinians have to carry out against themselves to exist in the West, right? While also drawing a line between, you know, the way that these places that we live in engage with Israel and fund Israel and are, you know, very much complicit in everything that Israel is doing to, like, you know, in a lot of cases, our own families, right? So I think that what she did was she created a bridge between all of these things. Like, I remember when I was reading, like, sort of earlier drafts, I was like, she's connecting so many dots that I just didn't, it's not that I didn't think about them. I just didn't even have language to connect them all to each other.
Mm. And so when you're going about finding pieces that you want to publish, you come at it first by saying, hey, this is a thing that we aren't talking about, or you come at it from this is a person who I think might have something interesting to say, or how are you kind of shaping the publication?
So I think that because of where I came from, the instinct very easily can be, well, this is what people aren't saying, or this is what people aren't talking about. But I actually think that to me is the present. You need to think about the future. So it's like, I don't want to be a media critic. Like, I think media criticism is very important. And I think critiquing the sort of powerful institutions that exist in our spheres is very important. But also, I don't want the publication to be a response to those publications, right? I want it to be, you know, thinking about, okay, you know, because I think people don't realize, you know, in a couple of years, a lot of the publications that we have known are going to collapse, right? Like, you know, for example, Barry Weiss being put in charge of CBS News. Like, that's not that, like, yes, that is part of the Ellison's, like, you know, very evil agenda and all this stuff, but it's also a Hail Mary, right? Mm. It's like CBS News has been in decline for a long time. And, like, you know, they're bringing someone like her in as a Hail Mary because they think she's going to bring in this younger audience. And I don't think that that's true, right? So, like, you have, like, I actually genuinely, I saw, like, beyond the evil, it was like, you guys have run out of ideas. You're like, I guess we'll just try to put this person in charge. Mm-hmm. Maybe it'll work, you know? And so, like, I think people don't realize how, like, screwed the media is right now. And that, like, in the past, yes, there was so much value to, like, being media critics and pointing out these things. And we should keep pointing out these things and we should keep holding them accountable. But we have to acknowledge the fact that their power is in decline and their readership is in decline. So in response to that, we need to think about, well, what's the future? And how do we come up with a future that actually reflects the truth and actually does the job, right? So part of it is, yes, like, okay, these are the gaps that I felt like I experienced and that I saw in these places. Then the other thing is, you know, going to writers and being like, you know, what's the thing that you've been wanting to write that you haven't been able to write? What is the, you know, what is the, like, because in a sense, in a lot of ways for writers, like, in it's taking their skills, especially if they're from, like, a background that's more specialized, and combining it with my skills, which, like, for a lot of people out there, this isn't really necessarily something that people would know about me instinctively. But, like, most of the time that I spent at BuzzFeed News, I was building the audience team. So my sort of, like, core knowledge area and, like, function as a journalist has been, like, thinking about how do you get people to think about things and read things and engage with them. And I have had to think about that, you know, from a wide range of subjects, right? Like, whether it was, you know, a 4-year investigation into, you know, nuns abusing kids in Vermont, which actually was one of the most horrifying things that I had to kind of work on, to, like, you know, an investigation into, you know, I don't know, like a sort of, like, more casual, I don't know, like, pop culture thing or whatever. Right. So, like, I had to think about that as a universe. Right. So I'm very much thinking about, like, okay, these are people I really respect and I really love their writing and I really love their work. How do we translate? So in a sense, I kind of almost see myself as a translator, and as a partner to sort of helping some of these writers have more reach for the things that they're publishing. And so there's that. And then also, I mean, just literally like, you know, what are the things that, you know, if these places had, you know, had cojones, like what would they publish? You know what I mean? Like, or like, what would they publish like a normal person without being scared, you know? So kind of thinking about all of those things together.
Yeah. I mean, I think to me, one of the really important things that, that PALFest did and that the Key is doing is forming these new kind of connections and new pathways. I mean, sort of the New York Times, the New Yorker, the Atlantic have a specific way of relating to audience, relating to their writers, readers, et cetera. And these kind of like pathways that people have been going down these ruts for a long time. And I think, you know, one of the important things that we need to do is to form new pathways, new ways of not just, you know, relating to audience, but making connections between these different points.
Yeah. Yeah. And also not assume, because I think the most sort of like misunderstood thing about like audience work is, you know, that like, that we, that the kind of like core important thing to do is to treat the audience like they're stupid.
Mm.
I think like readers are hungry to be sort of informed, and they want a high standard, and they want rigor, and they want you to be able to be really transparent and clear about why you're saying what you're saying and to show your work. And I think like, especially, I mean, both of you probably encountered, you know, the archetype of the foreign correspondent, you know, I've had this conversation so many times with foreign correspondents who are normally white men, and being like, you know, when you say you're nostalgic for some older version of foreign reporting, let me tell you what you're nostalgic for. You want to be Hemingway sitting at the like whatever cafe in your hotel, knocking back gin and tonics and making up whatever fantasy some guy in the Ministry of Interior told you, right? Like, and no one was going to hold you accountable for that. That's not the story anymore. And so I think that like, that is very much the world that we live in, that people are like, don't be condescending towards me, and don't make me feel like I can't go and see what you've been using to tell the story, because now everyone has the same tools as reporters for the most part, beyond like sort of boots on the ground, you know, phone calls and reporting and stuff. Right. So like, got to treat people like they're adults. Sorry. That's one of my many rants.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is an important point too, though, to not sort of romanticize the past. If there was good reporting by that foreign correspondent, probably it was done by their fixer and their translator.
Yes.
But to look forward to a different way of doing things.
Yeah. No, and people, I mean, this was a, you know, this was a, someone pointed out to me that, you know, in Gaza, you know, these journalists who popped up and were very visible. I mean, not that they've been obviously working for a really long time, but like, you know, the journalists who've been very, very visible. In some cases, some of these people would have been, you know, still doing the same amount of work, still being targeted the same amount, still like surviving through everything, but they wouldn't have been as visible because they would have had these white correspondents taking all the credit for their work.
Mm.
You know, and I mean, that was like, that's the thing, is that like, you know, foreign correspondents, you know, obviously like it's very, there's this like very, difficult thing, right? Where like you see a lot of people move through these bureaus who really, really, really care about what kind of work they're producing and what they're putting out in the universe. But, you know, there is this culture where, you know, what a foreign correspondent was doing was they were representing the ignorance of the audience and going and being just as ignorant as the people who were back in, like, let's say the US, right? So like, I think like really thinking about, you know, what role did they play in foreign policy and shape? And certainly we saw this, I mean, pick your, you know, American foreign adventure and how the media played into both encouraging and justifying these wars, right? So like, I think that like, yeah, I don't want to like sound like I'm saying that like all foreign correspondents are like this, but I think we do have to scrutinize, you know, the very specific role that these places have played in furthering the most like disastrous human rights you know, stains on the US, for example, right? Like, I think that we have to be able to talk about that. Sorry, another one of my rants.
No, that's, I mean, what strikes me too, though, is like, so, I mean, we're getting a little bit off on a tangent here, but like when I was a very, very baby journalist in Cairo, like, so I arrived in Cairo the year that the Iraq war, the year that the US invaded Iraq. Mm-hmm. And then I saw in like the cohort of people my age, like, I think what was a shift in the sense that there were post 9/11, post Iraq war, like a lot of Arab American journalists and people who did speak Arabic and like, you know, Ashraf Khalil and Hannah Alam and Leila Fadl and a lot of like, I thought this is something different as opposed to like the generation that you'd seen maybe before where like most correspondents were like male and white and whatever. Mm-hmm. And these people did, you know, and Anthony Shadid and like, you know, a lot of people who went in there purposely to like tell the story differently and with real context and with real language skills. And it still didn't change what we're talking about in terms of, do you know what I mean? Like, US foreign policy in the region, like treatment of Israel in mainstream media, like no matter how many qualified, really well-intentioned, really informed people were working, it still couldn't seem to break the barrier of like, I saw the same sort of like cliches that I experienced 20 years ago come right back, like weeds, you know? Yeah. It's like 2 years ago. I mean, like, I don't know. It just seems so then it seems so like structural or I don't know. I don't know it's like.
It's demoralizing. Like, I think that's the thing is that like, I feel like there were so many of us who became journalists because we wanted to fix something, right? Like we thought that there was, you know, we saw the, like for me personally, like I was in high school when the WMD thing happened, you know, like I feel like for me, that was an important point in me, experiencing the colossal sort of impact of bad journalism, but then also being like, well, you know, there just aren't enough people in the room who can sort of speak to these things from a different perspective and all of these things, right? But then the problem is that I think that, you know, especially for Arabs, you know, there's so many people, all the people that you mentioned are heroes, right? And
absolutely,
so many more.
Amazing, amazing journalists.
And, but like, you know, that was also another one of my sort of like thought starters for the key was like, well, okay, what would people like that publish if they didn't feel like they had to do all of this fighting and negotiating in order to get the story that they want, right? Like, I think that like that for me, because we all know this, right? You see how much people have to push and to be seen as reasonable, to do this, to do that. And this is always something I point out whenever like we're kind of talking about, you know, sort of like the mainstream kind of outlets and the problems. It's like, one, I think a lot of these problems are structural, but I was like, two, we can all acknowledge that good work comes out of these places. It's just that we, everyone on in this conversation has seen the behind the scenes of pushing some of these stories. It's so much effort. And then you sort of see how these lies get reproduced and republished, you know, when like we are like, well, why aren't these things held to the same standard? Like, just use the same standard. Like, why is it so easy to publish some wild, wild, like, report based on an unnamed U.S. official, which has become a trope, a complete joke in when it comes to reporting, and yet people will still write stories based off of that. And we're like, when will this, like, sort of standard of big quotation marks like neutrality be applied the same way? Because, you know, I don't see these like sort of like old school white journalists. And I want to like also add the class layer here because I think it's extremely important. Like someone who came out of this, like, you know, Harvard ass, Princeton ass culture, who has, you know, came out of the womb and was like, I was always correct and I will always be correct. That person is never going to scrutinize their biases. That person thinks that every sentence that they commit to the page is gold and is God's word, right? Like that person has never, ever thought that there was a possibility that what they had to say was nothing but the factual truth, right? So that to me is the like fundamental rot in some of these places.
Mm. I mean, to me also, my experience working in US journalism, there was already like a box that I was just like sort of inserting different sentences into. There was like an expectation of exactly how each piece that I wrote was going to look like in every aspect. And then I had this experience of writing for Lina Atallah in Cairo, and she really wanted to kind of reinvent how we approached journalism. Sort of, this was in like 2013, I think. Mm-hmm. Really wanted to reinvent how we approached journalism. You know, just basically like throw out anything that you know, other than we want to tell the truth, we want to be straightforward, we want to be real with our readers. But all those other rules that you were carrying with you, forget them. I think that there are certain aspects of U.S. journalism that have become so fixated that it becomes hard for them to say anything real.
Yeah.
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 And then the other space that I think like the key addresses very much, like obviously is the cultural and arts and literary space, where there's also sort of this a lot of these same kind of like constrictions play out over like issues of representation, basically. And it's sort of, it's in a more like in the literary or the movie or the art space, but like, in terms, like, still, again, about what can or can't be said, right? What is or isn't, like, appropriate, or who can or can't be invited to speak and all these sorts of things. And you guys have published poems and writing. And then I was also interested to see that you have this movie review of the film, The Voice of Hind Rajab, which I haven't seen yet, but I've read quite a bit about, including criticisms that are sort of similar to this criticism, to this, I think, very like measured and thoughtful criticism of the film. And I was interested to see that too, I think the space of criticism, it's interesting to also have the opportunity to like really react to work again without any of the like kind of like usual cliches or strictures.
Yeah. I mean, that was something that that's been a big discussion for us, right? And when I was in Palestine, this was a conversation I was having with writers there too, you know, which is that just generally, like, you know, we need to be able to critically engage with art that is produced around Palestine and about Palestine, but in a way that I think that generates healthy conversation. And also, you know, I think that the thing for me, for example, with The Voice of Hind Rajab, I felt like Muhammad's perspective was so important and so thoughtful. And I think like actually exactly the lane that I want, you know, this kind of discussion to happen, which is that, you know, it doesn't, you know, number one, we can acknowledge how difficult it is to push for projects like that, right? And the sort of like labor and work and all of the things that go into building these things, while also not allowing that to shield us from having real conversations, right? And I think that this is like, you know, even in the journalism sphere, right? You see this like very huge investigation on Palestine and stuff, and you're like, the instinct is to be like, well, I'm just glad that this was made, right? Mm. I think we're at the point now where we can be like, okay, let's have a conversation. Like, let's have a... let's like take a step back and have a conversation about what the value is in this, or what is the thing that this brings up, and what is the cultural conversation we should be having, and doing it in a way that's not attacking someone, right? Or like, it's not about, you know, tension within like a certain kind of like narrow context, right? I think it's about like thinking about what purpose should art serve right now, and what like what should these literary institutions be doing right now? What should be these cultural institutions doing right now? Like, what are the books that we need to have? What are the movies that we need to have? Like, what are the stories we need to have? And, you know, a lot of people aren't going to necessarily see eye to eye on that. But I think something that I feel like a conversation I've had a lot is that, like, I feel like we give, you know, Zionists a lot of space to sort of like learn and change and evolve. Right. Like I think people gave Peter Beinart, for example, a lot of grace to like sort of evolve very publicly the way that he has. I think that like within the context of both Palestine and people thinking about Palestine, we need to be able to, I don't know, critically like sort of and healthily engage with the people on our own side, and to be able to like have conversations and disagreements that are healthy and that are important for moving us forward, you know? So, and I think that sometimes those conversations happen at a really high temperature. And mm-hmm. I think that, you know, I feel like no matter what perspective some people like I've spoken to about this have, like, it's like almost like it's like, I think it's because in the US, the conversation about Palestine has been so centered around the sort of like Jewish identity and Jewish perspective that the Palestinian perspective feels on the periphery of it. Right. And so I think like sort of thinking about like, well, you know, what does it look like when we have this conversation and there isn't, you know, just room for one person to speak or two people to speak, or they have to just be from this one perspective. What does it mean to have a conversation? I don't know if any of that makes sense, but that's
yeah, kinda, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think it would also be easy for this to be a publication that was about boosterism, right? That was about just like saying nice things about any Palestinian thing in the public domain. But I think there are those kinds of attempts, whereas this is completely different about creating conversation.
Yeah, I think certainly as a reader and a critic myself, like I like to see also the work get the attention and thought that the work deserves. Like, I think, you know, Palestinian filmmakers and writers working under these, incredibly tough circumstances with so much weight on them from so many different directions also deserve their work to like not be reduced, to be like properly engaged with, which includes, like you say, like healthy criticism, but like, you know, where they're like treated like the artists that they are.
Yeah. And I mean, I think, but this is the thing, is that I think that like something that I feel like I struggled with when I was sort of in more of the mainstream spaces I was in was just like kind of seeing people who are in positions similar to me sort of, I think that we like almost like struggle to kind of like deal with the sort of criticism that might come in these contexts, right? So I'll give you an example. You know, one time at one of the places I worked, they published something that some folks found some issues with, and someone texted me and they were like, well, I'm nervous about posting about this publicly because I don't want you to feel like I'm attacking you. I was like, look, if my perspective is that this is a structural problem, then I can't take that personally, right? I am not the summation of American media. Just because I was, you know, entered any of these places that I'd been in at any level, it doesn't suddenly absolve these places of the things that they've done and the things that they continue to do, right? So it's like, for me to sort of be in those spaces and to be like, well, I'm here as like another perspective. I can't like just be like, well, this is, it's really like, I can't let how hard it is to do certain things and the sort of like grind of how kind of like you know, difficult. I mean, demoralizing it is for, I mean, all of these journalists I've spoken to, like sort of having to argue that the subjects that they're speaking to are human beings. And this isn't just a Palestine thing, right? Like, it's like, think about it from immigration. You think about from what the police in the Black community is. Like, you see and you feel how hard it is to do that, to push for those stories. And so when your community comes at you and attacks you and is really upset with you, your sort of instinct is to be like, please just be grateful for the inch that I've pushed for this. When actually what we have to do is let that discomfort exist, right? We should engage with the anger and hurt of our own communities. Like, that's, it's difficult, but we have to do it because it exists for a reason. And the patience that we give to people like who are, you know, from like a sort of outsider perspective to like live, learn, and grow through this issue, we need to show our community the same grace when it comes to saying things that they feel like they haven't been able to say, or things that they haven't, you know, things that they have felt the direct impact of, right? So like, I think that like that compassion, I think, is just like such an important thing. And I know for me as an editor, I know I'm going to make a lot of mistakes. I know there are going to be some bad calls that I make. I know there's going to be things that I say and do that like people might not like, right? And I might not agree with someone else's perspective, but like if it's coming from this community, I have to engage with it. I can't just write it off.
Mm. So just to kind of roll back, you were talking about, you know, how this sort of anti-humanization also works in a context of militarized borders and, in Black communities in the U.S. And the key, one of the things that sort of we noticed about the key is that it says that it will focus on Palestine as the core issue at the heart of the modern world. And I wondered if you could kind of talk about how the key will also, whether or not, you know, it brings in these other issues, how the lens that is being sort of developed there can be used to think about other things.
Yeah. I mean, I think the reason why we put that language in is because we think it's the connective tissue to a lot of things, right? So even, you know, and it does intersect with so many of the important things that we're talking about, right? Because, I mean, even for example, you're thinking about the US, like, you know, there is nothing more sort of relevant than thinking about this like Palestine exception, right? Like that's an important part of thinking about US politics. And, you know, certainly I think in the interview that we published with Ta-Nehisi Coates, you know, we had a big conversation about, you know, the sort of like fallout from the 2024 election and the kind of ties between the Black and Palestinian communities and like different cities in the US. So I think that the very sort of important thing is that there is this sort of like intertwining point, but I think we're also exploring what that means, right? So I think that part of that is, you know, I feel like to go back to the conscripted container, that is like, you know, you want to talk about psychoanalysis and you want to talk about this sort of realm, this is one of the ways that intersects with Palestine, or like thinking about like, you know, and I think that as time goes, I think it'll be interesting to see how that sort of evolves. I think that right now it's been just thinking about, okay, how do I write something or publish something in this realm that, like, for example, music, right? Like we published a profile of Heiko, Palestinian rapper. Like it's like, you know, and doing this sort of like culture reporting that hits on these like different lanes and these different arenas. That's sort of how we're sort of using it as that kind of organizing point. And I think, you know, there's like, you think about, for example, like if you think about like these like cultural institutions and stuff, right? Like just, you know, for example, the conversation about, you know, Hollywood and like sort of these, all these celebrities, kind of either speaking up or, you know, there's like different kinds of censorship. So like this hasn't been published yet. It'll be published hopefully in like about a month or so. But, you know, we have a story coming that's about censorship in Hollywood, right? Like, I think the person I asked to write it, Alex Press, who is a phenomenal labor reporter, you know, Alex looked at this, you know, much discussed phenomenon through the lens of like her beat, which is labor, right? And you know, mm-hmm. she did this like phenomenal job reporting on the writer's strike and the strikes, like the Hollywood strikes in Los Angeles, like through this like labor lens. So, you know, it's not just being like, well, this form of censorship exists, but also being like, you know, these are some of the ways that it was impacting people through the lens of this person's very specific beat and their specific kind of like universe of knowledge, if that makes sense.
Mm.
Yeah. So it connects to labor. It connects to freedom of expression. I mean, I think we can all map out many, many webs in our head, but I do think it'll be interesting to see how you say with time, you guys kind of like articulate through practice what this means too.
Yeah. And I think that like, and also because you don't want to write the same story over and over again, yeah. right? Like, I think that's, but also you want to think about what are the spaces that, you know, where you probably should see reporting that you don't see reporting, like even, because, you know, in these places you have one shot or two shots or three shots to push for some of these stories, and you're going to prioritize the humanitarian stories because they're the most important ones. Right. And also you are speaking to sort of this like baseline that needs to sort of like see the horrors. Right. So part of this is to think about like, well, we're saying that this intersects with so many parts of the world. How do we like really explore that? How do we talk about that? And, you know, some of the ways that like, you know, and also it's hard though too, because this like, free speech kind of question and this censorship question is so important because of what the culture wars have shoved down our throats, which is that woke is trying to censor everything when in fact it turns out, you know, it turns out the people,
lo and behold,
there's only one group that needs to understand that facts don't care about your feelings. And I can tell you, it's sure as hell not the pro-Palestine people. So like, you know, that like, that is like one of the kind of like, you know, you're like talking about, there's this been this big, like cultural shift. None of the institutions are meeting the moment. There's like a real problem you're solving for, which is like, okay, so if that's the new baseline, what stories do I tell? What are the things that I need to shed light on? What are the things that people need to understand? And what are the connections that people don't know about, right? Because like I have one story coming that's about like, you know, why Nigeria is so pro-Israel, right? That might not be something people were thinking about, but it's something they should know about. Mm-hmm. You know, thinking about, you know, so yeah, so I think even like, thinking about like Tucker Carlson and how, you know, this is something I haven't assigned anything on yet, but you know, like just like understanding these different kind of like cultural touch points, which honestly all, cause like Palestine was really like the linchpin for all of these things. And you just really saw it collapse. And we all would say this right before the genocide. Sometimes when I would say this, I would feel a little like, I'm so sorry. This is like my second My Big Fat Greek Wedding reference in 24 hours. And I promise I don't normally do this. But like, you know, when the old man like tries to tie everything back to Greek and like says everything is like, I've always felt like that with Palestine, where someone would talk to me about something and I'd be like, that's connected to Palestine. Let me tell you why. And then it turned out to be true. Like that's like, and I think everyone's seeing that and they're feeling that.
Yeah.
Well, certainly, I think it was a moment for a lot of people when the way in which they related to the media and information shifted, you know, from October 2023 through October 2025, that period. I think maybe, you know, that really should have happened during the Iraq War. I mean, it should have happened so many times already, let's say. But I think that it was transformative. seeing that happen so viscerally, feeling the feeling of being lied to by these systems and structures.
I mean, it's interesting because I do feel like, you know, like on the one hand, I think that there was this sort of, I mean, I think the way I've been describing it is like people can see behind the curtain, right? Mm. They see so much information. And I think that journalists, their response to this was to just pretend like it's not happening. And I think it becomes either you are very dismissive of how our culture has changed and how our relationship to truth has changed, or, you know, either you like completely go down the cynical route, which I think a lot of these like very sort of like, you know, kind of very partisan, very polarizing figures have like gone down. I'm not talking about the people who've actually been reporting. I'm talking about the sort of like American discourse that like you have either people in the sort of like broader media thing. They're just like, well, nothing is true. Everything is people's perspective. Everything's partisan. Call it a day. Or people are like, this whole thing doesn't exist. And the only thing that matters is what we say as reporters high up on the Hill. And we're going to pretend like people still trust what we have to say. And I think that, like, you know, you do need reporters and journalists. And I feel like actually the gold star of how to be a reporter in this day and age it's been the reporters in Gaza, right? These people were doing their fucking jobs through a genocide. They were doing their jobs and they were doing them well, right? In fact, no one has any excuse to be lazy and sloppy on this kind of a story if they just learn a little bit from the reporters in Gaza, right? Like, and what I mean by that is that they were rigorous, they were compassionate, they were truthful. And that's your job as a journalist.
And yeah, I think this is exactly what people were seeing, right? So they were seeing the New York Times headline that said, young woman, hit by bomb from nowhere, right? On the one hand, or we don't know what happened at this hospital bombing on the one hand, and then on the other hand, they could go to social media and find this very sort of sourced and rigorous reporting that was happening kind of out in the wild.
Yeah, no, completely. And this was the thing, was that like, so either like, they're just like, all of this is noise, I'm just dismissing it. Or it's like, you know, I'm just going to pretend like it's not happening. And that's why you saw all of these like international correspondents, you know, constantly shield themselves from criticism by being like, well, I can't go into Gaza, so therefore, how am I supposed to know what's happening? And it's like, girl, pick up your phone. You know what's happening. You know how to verify something on social media, because this is something that like has standards and has a practice. Like, we know how to do this stuff. Yes, it's become more difficult. Yes, AI has kind of screwed things. But like, you know, I don't know. You can tell when something is an old video. You can tell when something has lines that are too smooth. You can tell if, like, you know, Trump is eating corn by the like edge of the river and, you know, blood starts coming out of his ears, that it's maybe AI. Like, I don't know. Like, your job is to report. So report, right? And so I think that, like, so on the one hand, I think it's so critical, that we think about what does it mean to do our jobs well with that context in mind, and not to pretend like it's not happening and that like we don't know what it is and what it means to build we need to evolve when it comes to our standards and what we owe to our readers in relation to what kind of information they're consuming. When it comes to like Iraq and, you know, Vietnam, like, which I think are two kind of important points that I feel like I've been thinking about a lot as I've been thinking about like my career and like how I wanted to change and the other things I've been thinking about, is like, you know, the practice of embedding with the military was like was partially developed by the US government as a way to stop what happened in Vietnam from happening during other US invasions, right? Like they felt like these journalists who covered Vietnam exposed too much, right? And they wanted to control what reporters were reporting and what they could see. And we felt the catastrophic impact of that, right? And like, this was something that also came up in Afghanistan. You're like, you are only reporting from the perspective of one side. So, you know, and I think that like, it's so maddening to have been in this moment and be like, did we not learn anything from Iraq? Like just sort of seeing these sort of like bad faith rumors and ideas being pushed out to justify these like catastrophic policies and these catastrophic attacks and these catastrophic wars was like, it was maddening. I was like, what's the point of ever having tried to like sort of be in one of these places and to like push for things to be better? I'm just ranting again, but that's.
Well, I want to say thank you so much for coming and sharing your ranting with us today. I think it really, these are extremely important questions, as, you know, so many media organizations are, you know, reducing their staff so much, getting rid of anybody who was in the Maghreb al-Mashraq on the ground, and that, you know, of course, we encourage everybody who's listening to go and subscribe to The Key and subscribe to The Key financially, you know, support it financially if you can.
It's a very modest contribution that you can, the one can start with, and it is absolutely totally worth it. And yeah, we're lucky to have this, and they're lucky to have you, Sari. I think this is going to be amazing.
Thank you so much. I'm lucky to have you guys. So this has been really wonderful. And I will say also, yes, please subscribe. And it is very important to me to try to keep that lowest tier. So the more people that subscribe, the more likely it is that I can do that. So, because it's extremely important to me that The Key be accessible. Like the number one thing you're going to hear me bang on about is I want things to be accessible and clear. So that's very important to me.
And we were going to ask you to say goodbye by reading a poem, one of the beautiful poems that you guys have published.
I would be honored. So I was thinking on this, and the person I would like to, all the poems are amazing. Everything that we've published has been incredible. My favorite thing is to read things that I sit there and go, man, my brain is absorbing so much. So I've just learned so much from every person I've worked with through this process. So, but the poem I want to read is from Tamara Nasser, who is a Palestinian journalist who works for Electronic Intifada. And I think, I think because we've been talking about journalism, it feels nice to like kind of close with a poet journalist. So this poem is called The Eloquent Act. It has been said there are men who fight all their lives. Those are the indispensable ones. Me, I'd like to think of the eloquence of men, a fighter filling the city of his birth with lead. An enemy's discorded drone tracks him from above, wounds him open, and he sits up. He bends himself forward like everything else that comes from mud, prostrated, open to his creator, a pool of crimson that flowers on his back like a broken heart. This is the image we should not see, not one of us should name. There are men who remember their mother's milk. There are men who see the shoulders of language and nod. It's not indifference, no, but tell me something I can know for sure. There are men who choose. Those are the decidedly eloquent ones.
Subscribe to Bulak wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Twitter at Bulak Books and Instagram at Bulak.books for news and updates. Please rate or review us, and if you'd like to support us, you can make a donation on our page on DonorBox. Bulak is produced in collaboration with the podcast platform SOWT, S-O-W-T, which produces many other excellent shows in Arabic on music, literature, media, and more. For all things related to Arabic literature and translation, you should visit ArabLit.org, where you can also subscribe to the ArabLit Quarterly. If you are interested in advertising on Bulak or sponsoring episodes, contact us at bulak@sout.com. All the links and addresses mentioned here are in the show notes.